Good day, everybody. I'm Brian House. If you don't recognize my voice, well, you should. You should listen to my podcast at some point.
You're busy listening?
Wait, hold on. Turn off this podcast and go listen to Work For It right now. Just shut this off. Hey, unsubscribe. No, I'm kidding.
You know what,
I'm kidding.
Brian? That'd be great if you were actually on your podcast.
Hey, man, I try to be everywhere. Paint the earth. Paint the earth with all the Work For It and Brian House content I can possibly do.
There you go.
That's a familiar voice. If you haven't heard it, that's Brian House. You should have heard it. I listen to Work For It podcast all the time. It's a weekly podcast that comes out that's based on business in the shop. And you know what? That's one of the things that we brought Brian onto the show for today, that we really want to focus in on and talk about business in the shop and how to understand business a little bit better. Before we get into that, though, let's start this off with our regular good day, eh? Welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North.
That's talking about Canada, eh? And Lando kind of talked quite a bit about Brian House. If you haven't heard of him, you need to go out and get yourself a Revolution Grinder. Those things are badass.
Yeah.
Badass. And the Apollo Forge. Man, that is a killer ribbon burner, man. That is just
thank you.
Awesome. That's awesome. Man, so what is on the, what's coming up? What's the next thing?
Next thing. Oh, geez.
Just like that.
Yeah, just like that. Boom. Yeah. Let's go right into
that's
it.
Right. Shotgun
you know, honestly, it's summertime and I live way far south of you guys, you know, down in South Florida is where I'm located. And so it gets like super hot here. And it's interesting because when most people are off doing summertime traveling and, you know, kind of relaxing and stuff, we do infrastructure updates, you know, because it's our slower period. And I talk a lot about that on my podcast, about the hammock and, you know, how I see business happening throughout the year. And I say, you know, January 1 is the one end of the hammock and you got December 31st on the other, and then it slings down in the middle, and you know, sometime around June, July, everything slows down. So we try to prepare everyone who listens or watches any of our content that this is the time to be building infrastructure, putting things in place that are going to set you up for the holidays, because, you know, as you guys know, this is our busy period. Like come September, October, people start shopping for Christmas. You should start making things for that run sometime in, you know, June, July. So we're doing that and we're preparing. So we're stocking our, you know, we make the Revolution Grinder, as you mentioned, and the Apollo Forge. And there's a lot of work that goes into those even before the customer gets it. So we cut the steel, we machine it, CNC'd. It's boxed and packaged. And so when you order from us, it goes right in. It's a label is put on it. It's shrink wrapped and it's out the door, usually the same day or the following day. All of that logistics takes an enormous amount of time. So we try to prepare ourselves for that upcoming rush that we get around Black Friday. New projects wise, I just haven't really been developing anything other than some super secret stuff that I'm working on that'll be released sometime around November. But I am having fun in my workshop and forge. I'm working on doing two projects. One, the big one is Housemaid University. I don't know if you've seen any of that, but what we're trying to do is create a video series that sort of like Work For It, where we bring the audience along for a project, but then we educate on the business and sales side. So you've probably heard me talk about the 50-50 rule. Half of your job is to make whatever it is you're making. The other half is to sell it, right? So a lot of creatives don't understand that process. So we are doing and filming an entire project based around making something. And then the other half is the business end. What did it look like to make it? How much did it cost? What did it cost to sell it? What did it cost to ship it? And then a breakdown of that. And so people can see, okay, making is fun. We like it. It's work. But it's business and we have to make sure our margins are right and that we're preparing for certain things to occur. And that's kind of been on my plate, you know, for the last month or two. We've been working really heavily on Housemaid and Housemaid University. And we just started shooting this week. Wow. So it's fantastic. Right. Having a great time doing it.
Excellent. No moss growing under your feet, that's for sure.
Never, ever.
I heard the concept of the Housemaid University come up on your podcast about a month ago, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And, dude, that's super exciting. I'm so pumped that somebody finally came up with this concept on how to educate the makers more on the business side, because where else do you get that other than maybe going to university for business itself? And as a maker, most of us don't fall into the category of wanting to go to university for business, right? And just kind of focusing in on what business is for us as a maker community or a small manufacturing facility, for example, like yourself, where you've got the forge that you're manufacturing and the grinders and that you're manufacturing. You're doing it on kind of a smaller scale basis compared to, you know, something like GM or whatever, right? But there's a fine kind of, you know, magic that comes to light when you're doing it on a small scale like that, that you if you understand it, you could shine. Like, who's talking about this on one of our previous podcasts? I can't remember. They were saying there's a formula to it. And part of that formula is just kind of, you have to sell yourself almost to the business. If you're not fully committed to it, I believe that's kind of where they were going with it. It was Alex Norden, actually. He's super honed in on business as well. That's Valhalla Ironworks. He was one of the gents from ForgeCast, right? So,
yeah. That's Alex Norden in Tasmania.
That's right. Yeah.
So
when it came to you going into your business with the metalworking, did you have an idea of how all of that worked already when it came to manufacturing and stuff like that? Or is this, that's all new to you? Like, where did you pick all that up from?
Well, I've been an entrepreneur for almost 20 years. Before I started Housemaid, you know, I owned a small computer repair shop. So I understood like what it was like to, you know, balance a checkbook and get a business loan and all that stuff that, you know, kind of comes along with entrepreneurship, how to hire somebody, what's HR look like and payroll and all of that. So I had that background, but I got burnt out. You know, I was doing that business for 15 years and it was service based. You know, the margins were really tough. You know, there wasn't a lot of money to be made unless you went like and expanded and had like 10 employees, which brought its own set of challenges.
Mm-hmm. But manufacturing's quite a bit different than that, right?
Oh, it's way different. In fact, when I started Housemaid, I really just wanted to be a YouTuber. I mean, I saw Alex Steele. I started making knives in my garage. I got inspired by guys like Will Stelter and, you know, just watching their process, and I got fascinated. And so I started down that road of making knives, doing metalwork. I taught myself how to weld, you know, little things like that. And I started filming myself in that process, you know, and listening to Gary Vaynerchuk talked all about, or still does, talks about document your process. You know, that's the easiest way to create content is document it. Don't try to create anything. Just document it and share it. And you'll find the people who want to follow along. And then as I'm doing all this work, I realize I can't afford a grinder. So I decided I'm going to make my own, and then went down the whole rabbit hole of figuring it out. Dan Camus, may he rest in peace, one of my favorite Canadians, he released a ton of content probably 10 years ago about grinders and VFDs and motors. And so I dug in and I became friends with him online, and we were chatting back and forth and talking, and he was kind of just giving me, you know, basically like every other metal worker or knife maker I've ever met, super friendly, nice, willing to share everything. No exchange needed. It's not a transaction. It's a friendship. It's common. It's like, you know, it's a brotherhood. And I realized that, you know, there's something to this. I found the people that I should be hanging around with. So as the Revolution Project became what it became, it was literally learning every day. Okay, how do I buy steel? Who do I get that from? You know, and then I would just look online, like, where's a steel distributor close to me? And I just go there and talk with them and find it. And, you know, and of course, as the project grew and my following grew, then those companies were reaching out to me. So it became a little easier. But I had no manufacturing experience, but I did bring along 15 years of entrepreneurial understanding that I then deployed when I opened Housemaid, and then I saw a market. I was supported. I found like a bunch of people who were willing to support me and, you know, spend money with me. And, you know, there was always a transaction there. Like if you bought something from me, they got what they paid for. But a lot of times those people were buying from me and saying, you know, I don't really need these plans, but I love what you're doing. And I want to just send you $25 for this PDF so that you can keep doing this. And that blew my mind. Yeah. And to this day, still happens. It blows my mind, man. It's an amazing community we have here.
It really is cool. I mean, there are so many people in this community. There's dickheads in every community, but let's face it, for the most part, you can reach out and talk to anyone, and they're more than willing to share all kinds of information. And, you know, yeah, it's a pretty cool brotherhood, or I don't know, community pretty much sums it up. Brotherhood, and touching on some, you know,
whoa, easy now, easy now. Hey, okay, so put yourself behind the sales desks in these steel plants and stuff like that you used to visit when you were first starting this off. How many times would you have said, like, being that person behind the desk, like, oh my god, this guy has no clue what he's talking about, cringe question
all the time. And what was funny is no one took me seriously initially, so I would send my drawings off to them and it would be like a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Sometimes I would never hear back. Like, it was just nobody even, they were just like, this guy's a moron. And so I would call, and then what really helped me is a buddy of mine, Kenny, who worked in the unit next to me. I kept telling him, like, we would, you know, I'd walk over there because it was a welding shop, and they would weld aluminum primarily. So I went over there and I said, all right, I'm lost. I need to know how to buy steel, and because I'm not having good luck. And he told me about the vendor that they use, and in fact gave me the name of the sales rep. He said, look, you got to talk to her. Don't talk to anybody, because I was dealing with somebody else. They had cut my parts and they cut them wrong, and I was paying like $1,000 for a prototype of just plate steel. And then I would get it back and all my tolerances were wrong. Everything was off, and it was partially my fault. I didn't really fully understand how laser cutting worked and all that. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot in that process, but they weren't helpful at all. Like, I would call them and go, hey, like, my bolts don't fit through these holes. And they go, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. That's the drawing you sent. And I'd be like, okay, well, what's wrong with it? And they go, we don't know. You know, they would just basically either hang up on me, or they didn't want to talk to me at all. And I'm spending $1,000 on a prototype. Meanwhile, this is the same place that sells all the steel to SpaceX and Elon Musk to put like rockets and, you know, so they don't give a shit about me, and that's cool. Well, now they give a shit about me, which is great, because I spent a lot of money with them, and we've grown so much. But it was plugging into that right salesperson who took me seriously enough, and it was like, okay, I'm gonna spend like $1,000. I know that doesn't sound like a lot of money to you, but it's a lot of money to me. And she'd say, no, I get it, you know, it's okay, we'll get this worked out. And that was all it took. And then bang, now I have, you know, they send a sales rep to my shop, like, you know, a couple times a month just to make sure I'm happy and all of that, because we do a ton of business. Beautiful. But I got looked at sideways by just about every single person, and especially when I got into CNC, that was a whole nother thing. Like, when we started actually machining the parts, because I had no idea how that worked. That was another, like, people are just like, how the hell are you? You just bought a $100,000 machine. You're just going to try to use it. I'm like, I'm going to learn how to use this thing. I don't care. I'm going to learn it.
I did.
One of those people. I freaking learned it.
I'm blown away, man. That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
That's super cool. So, okay. But how much value is there to being that person that's willing to put in those footsteps, those, you know, those questions that people cringe at, that you're a newbie. You're either going to ask somebody those questions or you're not going to know, and you're going to fuck up, right?
Yeah, ton of value. If you're concerned about the other person's judgment, you're never going to go anywhere. You should just learn that you're going to get judged no matter what you do, like where you are. So, like, let that happen and just ignore it. You know, I'll post content about something I'm learning, and I'll get comments about, you know, you're an idiot. You shouldn't do that. You know, and I love that, and because that means that I'm on the right track. Whenever I get someone who is willing to send me a message or comment publicly that I'm a moron, ding, ding, ding. I just won. I know now that I'm on the right track. And ask any content creator out there, Jimmy Duresta, Chris Powell from Full Steam Design. He knows, like, if you're watching Chris do his whole concrete thing, but like, he's doing this dry pour concrete stuff and he has literally pissed off the entire internet. Amazing.
I swear to God, he does it on purpose though.
Well, I know he does it on purpose. I know he does it on purpose and I love it.
Hey, that guy this morning that messaged you on Facebook and said, "Hey, I don't know if you should be melting that copper."
Oh, sure. Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, that was you.
And honestly, right. I always thought that the tips on plasma cutters and welding, you know, the welding inserts and all that kind of stuff, I thought that was beryllium copper. And I researched it.
Yeah. No, you're right. And so whenever I do stuff like this, I'm always full PPE. Like what Nick is referring to, I'm doing doing copper melts using an induction forge. And so like a moron yesterday, I dropped a bunch of brass into there, not wearing PPE.
Oh yeah.
Not knowing that brass is a mixture of copper and zinc.
Yeah.
So I saw the little ghosts coming up out of the crucible and I was like, oh, I should probably put on a respirator right now. You know, like I'm smart enough to do that. So I grabbed that. Luckily I didn't get sick.
Well,
so I started researching copper after you mentioned that, so I could figure it out.
Some brass has arsenic in it. Which is really nasty. Yeah.
So, really bad for you.
Yeah, there's no way to tell by looking at it either, right?
No.
You have to go to the manufacturer and you have to ask them. So you can do that. You can go and say, like, how was this made and what's in it? And they can give you a date.
Legally, they have to, right?
I think so. Oh, yeah. But a lot of these fittings are now made in China. So you don't really know what. There's no regulation like that, you know, so you don't really fully know. But I will say, when I have asked, and we work with some Chinese manufacturers, and I have asked for data like that, and they've given it to me. You know, they're pretty good.
Because I think what you used to get from China is not the same that you get from China now.
Yeah.
You know, they have really stepped up their game. They realize that they need to be putting out quality if they want to continue to do business in the world market. So
100%.
There's that. Not saying that we should go to China for everything. I don't believe that at all. And Brian keeps talking about the fourth industrial revolution and we are in it. And I believe that 100% or I wouldn't be in business today either. So there's that.
The fourth industrial revolution is important. And if you look at historical data that shows, you know, the different stages of industrial revolutions, and the definition of an industrial revolution is really just the use of technology to increase productivity or like GDP. It's really simple. It's kind of broad. But if you look at post-World War II, what happened in Japan, after the war, you know, there was a lot of devastation there. How they rebuilt their economy was literally in the garages of these small houses where people were, and still to this day, you can find these knife makers and artisans working in these little workshops that are attached to their homes. Mm-hmm. And they've been there for however many generations, and they're doing the important work of making things to sell. And that's just as it is.
They're passing that down to their kids, and their kids are taking over that business too. So, yeah,
we got sidetracked in the 80s because of greed and manufacturing, and which I have an interesting take on all of that because my dad was in China a lot when I was a kid, so he spent a lot of time over there setting up factories because he worked for a company called Amrock, and my hometown was a manufacturing base just outside of Chicago. And now it's the number one most dangerous city in the United States on the FBI list because, you know, there's just no work, you know, all those factories, there's just empty factories everywhere. Nothing's made there anymore. to the now, I will say they're starting to bring it back, but it's kind of sad to see that. But it's, the idea behind what we were thinking back then was, okay, it'll be cheaper to make, so we can make better goods cheaper and drop the price point on a lot of things. And that did happen. And we brought China up from a third world country to a first world country, which I really love. And I think that was important. But at the same time, we saw what that meant during the pandemic. You know, we have one place where all of our goods come from. So now we're shifting our thinking. We can still work with China, still accept that in what they're up to. It has nothing to do with politics or race or any of that. It has to do with diversifying our manufacturing base in the first world. So if you think about it, like, hey, I want to make grinders in Florida. How does that work? And it took a lot of, you know, prying and clawing and climbing to make it happen. But it happened because there's a community of people who want to support what we do.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that took a pandemic to like show everybody like, oh, I get it now. We can't continue to just keep importing things. It's like, you know, everything our grandfather said, you know, you got to make things here. You can't move it to, you know, you can't send it overseas. It's super important. We're just going to become a bunch of pencil pushers and paper staplers. And we literally did that for the last 20 years. Entire generations of people know nothing other than sitting in a cubicle. And it's some people, that's where they belong. But I got to say, a lot of people don't belong there. And it's awesome to watch them, like Superman, rip that shirt off and go in their garage and make something and sell it. And I love that.
Yeah, Nick.
Yeah, actually, that's what I'm doing today. We just finished a whole bunch of camping tripods and
beauty.
Yeah, the little. Yeah, we've been working like crazy building a whole bunch of Damascus. We've got some. We're starting to see a real uptick in our classes here. Like Brian said, this is, you know, we're in the belly of the hammock right now. I mean, this is when our slowest time, but things are picking up a little sooner than they were last year. So
you guys hone in on your advertising like crazy, man. Every day I see you putting out advertising, you know, knife classes available, and the advertisings are always, you know, you always put a good twist to it. You know, Chuck Norris, you know, would tell you to do this, or this is better than camping in the rain or whatever, right?
You know what? I got to say, I've got the world's best wife. She is amazing. She's, you know, she's all about the business, and she looks after my fat ass. I mean, she is awesome. But
it's no. You know what? It's funny that you bring that up, because I think there's something to that when it comes to business. Yeah. And Brian can attest to this, that if you have a good partner that works with you, man, you can skyrocket so much, because I see that with Brian, right? You and your wife work together on the regular, and it's because of that there's success. Do you think you would have that same success without your spouses?
No, not a chance.
Yeah. No. I've been married twice. Sarah's my second wife. My first wife, you know, we were younger, so there wasn't the same kind of story, but there wasn't that kind of layer of support there. Mm-hmm. And when I married Sarah, when I started dating Sarah, she comes from a family of entrepreneurs. Her dad's a business owner. She gets it. Yeah. Oh, you work 16 hours a day? That's it? You know, kind of thing, you know, like it's, she gets it. Like, she knows. And she's got an awesome story, but she came to work with Housemaid a little over a year ago because she was working at home, you know, doing her thing. She was a corporate branding marketing person, making a great living, working for folks who really don't care too much about her, you know, that kind of stuff. It was just a common story.
Wow.
And she got in an argument with her boss, and she came into my office, and she's crying. She's upset. And she's like, I don't know how many more of these meetings I can sit through. And I looked at her and I go, just fucking quit. Just come work with me. Just quit. And if it doesn't work out in 6 months, you'll go find another job. And, you know, it'll be fine. She like that day just gave her notice and was out. And she's been with us ever since. And from her coming into working with Housemaid, she's, you know, I told her, like, all you have to do is get our conversion rate up like 0.3%. That's it. I'm not even asking for a whole percent. I just want like a 0.3 to a half of a percent, which, as you guys know, is a lot. It's a big ask.
Yeah.
And so she started working on her branding. She rebranded us. She spent all this time on the website, and she did it. And it was like, okay, you just paid for yourself. Cool. What else can we do? You know? And it's, yeah, without a good spouse, basically, you don't need somebody you can work with. You just need somebody that's, when you come home, they support what you do.
Yeah.
And understand that sometimes you got to work a lot more than somebody that works and punches the clock, you know, 9 to 5 type.
Yeah. I think we may have married the same woman, because that sounds a lot like Shelley. She was with the company for 14 and a half years. She was their kind of their head trainer, and it was a medical software company. She was, you know, she'd been there a long time, and she'd really created quite a, like, she was part of that hub, you know, and just having a rotten time with her bosses, and didn't feel like she was supported at all or anything like that. Same thing, came home crying. I said, just fuck it, quit. You know, yep. we need you here. You know, you're going to be a lot more valuable here, and we're going to do a lot better. So yeah, she, after 14 and a half years, she gave him 3 months notice. Her boss didn't say a word to her for the first month after she gave her notice. Like,
that's your indicator that she made the right decision.
Oh yeah. 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 Like, that is, you know, it was,
it's awful.
That is, something's, it's horrible. Up. That's horrible. People don't like leave. That. People don't leave companies because they're not making enough money. They leave companies because they don't feel valued. They aren't being respected. They aren't. You know, there's a plethora of reasons why they leave companies, but it's not money. You know. Well, I mean, it is money at the same time. I mean, you know, if somebody's offering you a lot more money, then yeah, you go where you have to go. But
just so you know, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Just so you know, I'm your bra. I support you.
Oh, thanks, bra. Thanks, bra.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that.
I support you too, Lando. How's that hammer coming, by the way?
I just need to put the handle on it still there, you know.
There you go.
My time in the shop has been lacking lately, big time, because, number one, it's so hot here. And it's been swamp ass, like, kind of like feels like Florida, but I'm sure it's nothing like Florida comparably. But it feels like it here. I mean, you guys don't deal with minus 40. When you go from minus 40 to, you know, plus 30 in the summertime, Celsius, right? We don't deal with freedom height here. Sorry. And it's been so humid, dude. It's just raining like crazy. Honestly, man. And
Manitoba gets so freaking humid and muggy, and it's just, it's
terrible.
It's
I hate it.
It's a bad.
Well, it's, it used to be a giant swamp where we live, right? Like, literally, southern Manitoba was a giant. They're just finding a giant reptile dinosaur thing that they remains or whatever the other day, southern Manitoba.
Yeah,
this goes to show, like, you know, this was a giant lake at one time, and we were digging at the cabin, putting in a deck, probably like 25 feet up from the water level, because we're on a big slope, right? And we're finding rocks that have huge indication that at one time they were well within the water, because of the same types of, they've got the same grooves and whatnot that you find of the rocks that are in the water. So it was really cool to see that. Anyways, sidetracking ourselves here. I wanted to ask you, Brian, when you guys were talking about, you know, honing in on the business and China, excuse me, and ordering parts and stuff like that, you know, trying to strive away from China, but at some point you kind of don't have a choice but dealing with them for a lot of things. When it comes to ordering parts, you probably order in bulk, I would assume, for a lot of things, because you find that there's a price point or whatever that makes sense. At what point do you decide to start ordering in larger bulk form? And, you know, like, did you start doing that right off the hop, or was there a point in your business where you said, okay, now we start ordering in bulk?
Yeah, you have to have some historical data to look at, you know. So we have 4 years of data we can go and we run reports like once a month. I'll say like, what's our average, you know, like where are we at as far as how many grinders are we selling? How many forges are we selling? And then my goal is to limit, So I love lean manufacturing. Are you guys familiar with lean? Like whole point of lean?
5S.
So yeah, like you're trying not to stockpile, you know, a ton of things. But at the same time, there's kind of a breaking point where you go, it takes a lot to reorder and you're paying to ship it. You know, if you do have to order, like for instance, we order the handles on the Revolution are those adjustable handles. I wanted them cast in zinc and powder coated, which was really tough to find. Like there's not a lot of companies out there that'll do that. A lot of them will make them out of aluminum and I wanted them to feel heavy and industrial. There's one company in Detroit that makes them. So I reached out to them and it was like minimum order. I had to order 1,000 pieces, you know, to make that happen. And at the end of the day, that's a lot of money. And then because it's 1,000 of each type. So we need 3 different knobs from them. So it was a lot.
Yeah.
And one of the knobs, if I was going to order 1,000 of, I would need 3 times that for the other knobs because I used 3 of those. So it turned out to be a huge order. And I ordered and I realized, okay, if I order that much, it'll, you know, hopefully keep us going for, you know, a certain period of time. And then at that time, you know, then I took the historicals and went, how long is this going to last us? And what I didn't realize was they make them in China, really. They don't, you know, you're ordering it from Detroit. But they are made in China. And it takes a long time to get them back to the United States where then there's something else that happens. They make part of it in China, then the other part of it gets delivered here. And I try as much as humanly possible to get North American everything. Either Canadian steel or United States steel. I really make a point of that. So I always ask, like, where is the steel made? I don't want, you know, something made overseas. I really want to pay for American steel. And there's a couple of advantages to American and Canadian steel that you don't get when you order it overseas. But those things I had to have, you know, made. And I realized, okay, I'm going to take this historical data and I'm going to weigh it. And then essentially, like a card game, you pick where you're going to put your money. Are you going to spend all that money now or are you going to spend it later? Are you going to spend it over a trickle period of time? And it made most sense to do the big bulk orders of certain items over the course, like 3 to 4 times a year, rather than try to do that once a month and have it trickle in over time. It's less inventorying. It's less counting. It's less ordering and dealing with a vendor. You order it. It takes a few months to be made. It shows up and you're good for a while. But you can't get there unless you can't make that decision unless you have that historical data, and you can't do it without capital. You need money to do that. You know, talking about $20,000 order and just handles, and you're like, okay, I got to come up with 20 grand to buy all those handles. And what's interesting about those handles is they're so rare. You can't find them very much. And you can buy them through McMaster, but you're going to pay like 4 times what we would pay.
Yeah.
And so we're able to just sell handles now on the website. And people just come to the website and buy those because there's no other vendor that sells them in that capacity. So we make profit on selling handles to people who are doing other things with them. They're not putting them on grinders. They're putting them on other things. So
that's awesome. It works out. I got to wonder, when it comes to making bulk orders like that and what we kind of saw with the pandemic happening, the availability of stuff taking a lot longer to come in, and also the increase of price going up and up and up as time was going on. Did you at one point during that kind of pull the trigger and say, hey, if I pull the trigger now, I can save myself, you know, double my money instead of waiting to make this order in a year. Let's put down like a triple order right now before the prices skyrocket.
I didn't know enough about it. So I really just look, you know, when I made my first order of 100 grinders, which was a lot of money for me at the time, And then when I made the second order, like mid pandemic, and it was 400% more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's when I realized that I needed to really dig deeper into cost, you know? Yeah. And then, you know, of course we have inflation happening at the same time. And so, you know, those two things were playing off of each other. And here's what's really interesting. The prices have not gone down post pandemic. Of course the vendor goes, I did, you know, that stick of steel used to cost $50 and now it costs $250 and people are still buying it. So why the hell would I drop the price?
Yeah.
And I get it from a business standpoint. But there are also, you know, those people that are doing that are going to keep inflation up. It's, you know, at some point you have to look at your margin and go, is it a sustainable margin? Yes. Is it at a way above sustainable margin? If it is, it's time to bring those prices back down so that we can level out the economy. The United States government did a weird thing during the pandemic, and they gave away a bunch of money to business owners. They were just soliciting business owners to, you know, PPP loans, which was the payroll program that they were giving out money for people who were retaining employees, and then this other loan called an EIDL loan, which was an economic something disaster loan. And I'm like, you know, and they're offering me, you know, $100,000, and my revenues are super low. And I'm going, why are they offering me all this money? This is dangerous. And it's, so if you think about it, a guy that had, say, my revenues were super low and I'm getting $100,000, a guy's revenues in the millions, he might've gotten loaned, you know, $10 million.
Yeah.
At 30-year note from the United States government or the Small Business Administration. And they put a 4%, you know, cap on that. So now you're just paying 4% annually on that money. It's like a mortgage. Well, all these people, of course, if you're a smart business owner, you're going to take that deal. You're going to go $10 million at 30 years at 4%. And my revenue.
I could flip that over. Yeah, no problem.
That's right. Of course. Well, what does that do to the economy? Oh, now you flooded the economy with all this money, this cash, and it made a false. It basically brought our inflation higher. So now that's the reason why when you spend money at the grocery store, you pay more for everything, mm-hmm. because these guys all had money. So there was, you know, the economy is a very, very, very volatile thing, and it has a balance. That president that decided to do that, he was just trying to fix things at the time. And I get it. I understand why. It's just, well, now.
It wasn't just the United States. So that happened all over the world. The governments all over the world were doing that. And I mean, there's conspiracy theories attached to that, you know, we don't talk about politics, or we try not to talk about politics too much or whatever. But yeah. Okay. So now we are where we are with it, right? The prices have increased. Chances of them going down, probably not. Instead, what we all have to do is try to play catch up to that, right? Everyone's wages is slowly trying to increase, and during that time period now that we're stuck in, some may call it a recession now that we're in, right, where we're trying to play catch up on our wages to make up to where the prices of things are, groceries and rent and real estate, all these different things, cars. So while we're in this recession, there's an opportunity for businesses to really gain if they can, if you play your cards right. You know, for example, you can see other businesses going out of business and auctioning off all of their stuff for next to nothing. So as a business that's playing their cards right, you got a little bit of extra income, and you watch for these things, knowing that there's certain things that you can purchase to add to your repertoire to increase your revenue. But at the same time, during a recession, how smart is it for you to go and dump that extra revenue on something, right? Like, how do you judge that?
Yeah, I like to stay as liquid as possible with as little debt as possible. So, you know, I'm a Dave Ramsey guy. Like, I just believe in, like, wiping out debt, not taking on debt unless it's absolutely necessary. I lived through the 2006 to 2008 economic recession. That was awful. I had two small kids. I was an entrepreneur. And what I learned back then was cash is king. Cash is king. If you have money, you know, you can use that money and leverage it and use it as a springboard, you know, and get further. A lot of my contemporaries did not have cash. They were foreclosing on their homes. They had a lot of trouble, and it was because they just didn't have enough liquid to support, you know, themselves throughout that period. I learned a lot during that. Now, that's not this time, though. We are in a completely different time because our economy is not hurting. We do not have subprime mortgages happening. There was a lot of things that were a part of that. And as you can tell, I love economics. I think it's a fascinating, it's almost like biology. It's like one thing happens over on this side of the planet, and then, you know, like Greece fails, and then all, you know, some hedge fund fails, and then all of a sudden somewhere in California, big bank in California fails. I love
it. It's part of the balance of business. Totally. Though. I think you got it.
100%. And so when I talk about like the hyperinflation and the money being loaned out by the president or whatever, the political side of that doesn't mean anything to me. I don't care. It would have been done by Democrat, Republican. It didn't matter. It just, that's what needed to happen. But now when you look at the symptom or the after effects of this, you're seeing the people that are really hurting are the middle to lower class. And that's because they stayed working, but their wages didn't increase, like you were saying, Lando. And so here's what we noticed during that period. A lot of people had a lot of free time. They were still working, sometimes from home. And it was awesome to watch so many people grab their destiny by the shirt collar and say, I want to start making things in my garage to supplement the differences in inflation. And now we're watching a lot of those people resign from their full-time jobs because they realize, like Nick, it makes more sense to work on my projects and do the things that I'm going to do and control my own destiny rather than hand it over to somebody that could, you know, lay me off in 2 years because they didn't like the way I looked at them or whatever. You know, it's just crazy, right? So that's why I think the maker community became the maker economy is a $1 billion economy. I mean, the money spent on tooling, and it's unbelievable the amount of money that's turning over hands here. And I love watching what people are doing with it. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me that I'm a part of it, and I love being a part of it. And, you know, it's a great thing.
Yeah. When with recession, there tends to be opportunities that arise, and the maker community is a prime example of that. You know, people saw that there was a need, a problem, if you may, was amiss, and some people came along and solved that problem. They gave other people an option instead of ordering from China. You know, China made stuff or whatever, or factory made stuff. People want stuff that's unique, and they're willing to spend that extra money that they now have because of what was going on something unique. And as a maker community, we saw that opportunity and we jumped at it. Mm-hmm. Right. So, with the business side of things going into a recession like that, I guess, do you think that it was is a wise thing to hold on to your money at that point and ensure that you've got, you know, a safe pad under your belt versus taking the risks at times? Like, okay, so where I want to go with that, I guess, is for an example, and I kind of I feel like I'm repeating my question a little bit, but so I think I brought up Tom Bill YouTube before, right, Brian?
Yes.
I don't know if you looked into him at all, but one of his things that he brings up, he's the one that talks about how when there's recession, opportunity arises, and, you know, it's a great time for businesses to take a hold of those opportunities. But he also brought up something before about trying to take a 10-year plan and hone in on it as try to do that in 1 year. Try to accomplish what you think you can do in 10 years as a business and try to do it in 1 year. And I don't know, like when it comes to a recession, how do you approach that? Because, I mean, obviously part of that 10-year plan is to take a lot of risks, right?
Yeah. I guess I'm a more of a conservative. So I see, you know, making good decisions with the money that you have saved, or your capital. Let's just say you have $20,000 and you're a maker and you have decent revenues, you're paying the bills. But you're plateauing. You know, you've reached a level that, you know, let's say you have a revenue stream of, say, $5,000 a month. Okay. And at that $5,000 mark, you've hit that mark pretty consistently for, say, 5 months, 5-6 months. I would then look at, you know, the money I'm socking away. Let's just say I'm able to take $1,000 and put it away every month. So now I've got $26,000. And I'm saying, you know, okay, I've got this coffer of $26,000. I have to choose what I want to do with that money. And that $5,000 a month revenue cap, the only way I'm going to break that ceiling is either with a new piece of tooling or something that will make me more efficient, maybe hire somebody that can help you with marketing or start innovating and making a new product, which is going to cost money, right? It's going to cost R&D. Funds. Those are that's how I look at it. So every time I do a project, I spend a ton of time on it. And I, you know, over the years trying to perfect it and whatever else, but always, 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 I have a back pocket project that's going to take our plateau and move it to the next level, because I look at my business monthly and I look at it revenue wise. So I see how many grinders we're selling, how many forges we're selling, how many abrasive sets are we selling, you know, all these things. And now it becomes the law of averages. So as we grow, we're just adding things. I use the spider web analogy, meaning like I'm the spider in the middle of the web and all of my products around me are things that kind of play, you know, on that same thing that I'm doing, the metalworking and the grinders and the forges. And as I add to those webs, as I increase the size of my web, the more revenue is going to flow in. Well, of course, just like everything, more money, more problem. You're going to have, you know, more people now. You've got to have more revenues coming in. And if you had a bad month, what does that look like? Your overhead a lot higher. Did you buy another building or rent another space? And now you got to pay for that. You got an air conditioner.
Nick.
It's all these little things that as you play this game, the guys that I watch fail, there's one thing that they always do, and it's they don't hold enough liquid capital to dig themselves out. You should have, just like in your personal life, you should have a 6-month little fund, that emergency fund. Your business should also have, like, you know, probably not six, but like I'd say like 2 to 3 months of business capital that if sales were to drop or cut in half, you'd be able to sustain the drop. You'd be able to work your way through it because chances are that's not going to last. You know, things are going to turn around unless you're a real moron and you've made some really poor decisions. You know, the sales slumps come up and down. It's just part of, you know, the world. It's just things people buy one day and they don't buy the next. It's just the way it is. You have to be able to sustain that. So making good, sound financial decisions, having an emergency fund set up for your business, and then what does it look like to release another product or to market yourself a little bit differently? Or did another company come on the scene that's, you know, I say this all the time on the podcast, is if you're doing well and you're making money, there's somebody 3 steps behind you, right behind you, wanting to take it. Mm-hmm. So just remember that if you're not innovating and you're not constantly looking at your product and going, how can I make this better? How can I market this better? How can I add something to this product that would sell to the people who have already purchased this product? Things like that, those types of minds, it could be something as simple as a hook or a knob or something that will bring that customer back to your website. They go to your website, they're like, man, I saw Nick talk about that hook. I'm going to buy that hook. That's a really great hook. Oh, shit. Nick sells this now? I didn't know he sells that. Oh my God. All right. Now by the time they're out the door, they spent a couple $100 with Nick. And it all started with a $5 hook. And so unless you're thinking like that, you're going to have a bad time. I mean, it just is that you have to constantly be innovating. And I'm not looking behind me to see the guy 3 steps behind me. I already know he's there. There's probably 10 guys behind me right now. In fact, when I got some level of success with this business, a bunch of Brian House clones popped up all over the fucking world. And I took that as a compliment. I was like, look at all these guys trying to be me. That's cool. I like that. But I'll outwork every single one of you motherfuckers. I'm telling you right now, you have nothing on me. But at the same time, you never know. I might get tired one day and you might surpass me, and that's okay too. I'm a free market capitalist. I believe in the system. It makes everyone better. If you're chasing me and I'm chasing him, that's a good thing for the world. That is a good thing. And so,
and there's nothing to say that that you're necessarily going to work not as hard as them. They might just happen to be working just as hard as you, maybe not even working just as hard as you, but the market is that strong that they can support that business as well to grow just as much as you are, right?
It could.
And if the market is that strong, then that means by all means, people should be jumping at that opportunity to open business and solve that problem, because people need that problem fixed, obviously, if the market is that strong. But if you see that that market is weak, you have to start adjusting. Like you were saying, innovating. I kind of like to look at it as having a plan. When you start a business, you have to have a plan. You have to know where you're going with it. You have to have an idea of where you're going with it, but you're constantly adjusting that plan, right?
That totally changes all the time. You know, what your next plan is going to be.
You're a prime example of that, Nick, man. You're now looking at starting to do axes and hammers instead of just knives, right?
Oh, yeah.
You have to innovate to grow, right?
And just blacksmithing classes. There's people out there that don't want to make a knife. And that's fine. We call those guys losers, but whatever.
Whoa, easy now. Come on.
You've made a knife.
Take off.
You're a knife maker. You've actually sold a knife, too. You are definitely a knife maker.
Take off, loser.
I'm interested in the education model, Nick, because that is something I think could really take someone who's building things and selling things.
We're up to 40 to 50 people a week that come through our classes. So
holy smokes, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, in our busy months, it is crazy. But it's.
I don't like people enough. I can't work with the public. I would have a really time with it.
You know, I take a page from the Ron Swanson book every once in a while when people are too chummy. I call them by the wrong name just to let them know that I don't give a shit.
I love it.
Right, Mitch? Oh, sorry, Lando.
I love it. Yeah, you're doing the Lord's work. We did a foundry project down here where I had a bunch of guys come down and follow me after Blade Show. They came and hung out for a week. And one of the guys that came down, his name is Jordy, the knife maker. You can find him on Instagram. And this is a great story. So I had somebody drop out of the foundry project at the last minute. And at the time, I was emailing back and forth with Jordy because he was in Tampa. I had never met him before. Tampa's like 2 hours north of me. And he had purchased a bunch of our stuff because he runs a small blacksmithing and knife making school on his property. And he was asking me for something, and we were going back and forth, whatever. And I had never even heard of him. So I just went to his Instagram and I saw that he was local. And I started digging into what he was doing. And on a whim, I said, "Hey, you should come down for the foundry project. You're close. It wouldn't cost you much. You know, we're renting a house for everybody. You'd be staying with a bunch of, you know, fairly notoriable people. You know, these guys that are really talented. You're going to be sitting in the same space with them, hanging out with them. Would you like to come down?" I mean, 10 seconds, his response. Yeah, I'll come. Yeah, sure. I'm there. He came down and shared with us his journey of doing classwork, like what you're doing. And he's doing just simple knives, you know, kitchen knives, like forged out with very little grinding, just mostly forging thin and, you know, adding like wah style handles to these things. And, you know, he's crushing it. I mean, the guy is just killing it. And his classes are stacked up to the point where he's booked out months in advance. Mm-hmm. And his story is very interesting. He, you know, he's one of those guys that bounced around service-based industry, construction, you know, couldn't find his path. He hit the metalworking circuit. He started making connections. He started learning and teaching and doing all this. And he blew up. And so I think of it in terms of like somebody can go from being a valet and parking cars, making, you know, $10, $12 an hour, to, you know, pulling down a six-figure income by, you know, following these steps and doing this work. I mean, the guy is just doing a great thing. So, you know, if you guys want to go check out Jordy the Knife Maker on Instagram, you should check out his class models, because it's a really cool thing. And he shared it with everybody here at the Foundry, and it could change lives. It really could.
Man, B. Cohn should get an interview with him, man. Yeah. It'd be awesome 100%. To hear that story.
100%.
So, okay. The elements of business, the keys to success. Obviously, persistence, working hard, work for it, baby, right? But what are some of the other key elements of success that you would say you really want to hone in on when it comes to a maker business?
Hands down, relationships. Business will come down to relationships every time. You could have no money and not a lot of time and make the right connections with people and still be successful. And social media makes this super easy now. You have no excuses. You can connect with literally anyone. I'll give you a great example. Jeremy from Simple Little Life. We all know him. He's OG. Mm-hmm. The guy is like up here, right? Pedestal. And he's one of the original guys that I got inspired by. And I just sent him a message one day on Instagram or somewhere, and I got a response. And I was like, holy shit, Jeremy's actually talking with me, and, you know, back and forth or whatever. So I started my YouTube journey. And I think the question I had for him was something along the lines of like creating content. Like, I wanted to know a little bit about what that looked like. And because he was a full-time maker and content creator, and I wanted to get some like reality, right? And he gave it to me. And then, so nobody, not a lot of people know this, but he was on Knife Talk in the early Knife Talk podcast days. I think it was just Craig, or it was just Craig and one other person. And he was on Knife Talk, and Craig asked him, who should we be looking out for in the future? And Jeremy said my name. And it was, you know, he's like, Brian House is going to do it. Watch.
I think I remember that, man, actually. Right? That was... That back when him and Jeff were doing it, just the two of them.
I think it was just, yeah, it was just Craig, or it was only two people, I think, at the time. Yeah, maybe it was just Jeff and Craig. That is what sparked Craig to look into me. And then Craig followed me on YouTube and then offered me the Makery Network slot.
That's pretty awesome.
That's because I made a connection with Jeremy. And so... hands down, I mean, I don't know if Jeremy is like the thread that pulled me into this whole thing, and maybe we should give him credit because he would love that. But I will say that, you know, that relationship component, it didn't happen because I was just making content hoping people would see it. I was making content and then reaching out and talking with people and connecting, and which I wish I had more time for it now. But when people ask me questions, I always try to respond. And if I missed any questions, please, you know, hit me up again. It's not, don't take it personally. I get a lot of messages. But the idea here is that you cannot do this alone. It's impossible. You have to have support. And this maker community will support you as long as you support them. I watch guys who make content and it's really, really, really good. I mean, it's fucking top-notch shit, right? It should go viral. It should be, this person should have 100,000 followers on Instagram. They never once respond to a comment. They don't heart anything. They're not responding to their audience, and they're slugs, man. Their content is fucking top-notch, but they don't talk to anybody. They don't respond to a message, and they ignore the, you're left on red. And then when you see a piece of their content come back up later down the road, you go, fuck that guy. He's full of himself. He won't even respond to my DM, whatever. It is a real thing. People do hold that truth. So if you're not responding to your people, you're not engaging with your audience, you're doing yourself a massive disservice. It's like a sociopath. It's like, who puts all this shit out there and doesn't respond to anybody or doesn't say anything? It's just like, I'm going to create this amazing piece of content, have a million people watch it, and then not say, like, not answer a question. Not one.
it's the same equation that you were saying before, the 50-50 equation. 50% of it is the work, 50% of it is selling it. And selling it is responding to people, engaging with people that maybe it doesn't even have anything to do with what you put out there. You're just engaging with other people so that you know who you are and that you're a genuine good person, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Absolutely. 100%. I love it when somebody discovers me through something weird. Like they'll see like an old video or they'll, you know, somebody will share something of mine. They'll start following me. You start seeing the, like, this person follows you on YouTube. This person follows you on Instagram. So you can kind of start seeing the connection point. And then they discover you have a podcast. And like, I got a guy like messaged me or put a comment under one of my photos the other day. He goes, "You have a podcast too? You're everywhere. What are you doing? Yeah. You're everywhere. Wouldn't you have time to do this?" I'm like, "Bro, I wish I could do more. I want to be everywhere." Like, right. I said, the earth, I have a very specific narrative, a very specific rhetoric. It will never change. I will always be the same guy who thinks the best of you because I know it's in you. Even though you don't know it's in you, I'm going to tell you it's in you. And I'm going to say it all starts with hard work. If you can pick yourself up in the morning and get out there and do something with yourself, then you've got a big fighting chance to be, to change your life and be successful. Mm-hmm. People I will beat up a little bit are the people who go, "I'm doing this and it doesn't work. And I'm doing this and the algorithm is beating me down." And I go, "Psh, stop talking like that. Keep making content. Keep pushing forward. Stop looking at numbers. Keep pumping out content. Keep engaging with your audience. Keep talking to your customers. It will happen. Just keep moving forward. But if you're going to be a victim, then I'm going to slap you like a bitch. You're not going to like what I say. I'm going to tell you you're being a victim." And the victim mentality goes nowhere. You will fade into.
Preach it, brother Brian. Preach it.
Look at my reels. I don't know what the hell happened, but I was putting up reels like on a regular basis. Maybe once a day was kind of like a little bit of an exaggeration for me to try to hit, but I was trying for it, right? And, you know, the few of them, 1,000 views here, a couple hundred views there. Oh, wow, this one hit, you know, like 5,000, 8,000. Oh, wow, this one hit 10. Oh, wow, 20. Wow, that's awesome, 20,000 views. 750,000 views. What the hell is going on around here? Yeah, buddy.
Yes, and you don't even know why it hit, right? You have no idea. It's
the working for it, dude. The discipline to keep on engaging with other people, responding to the comments, putting out content on a regular basis, and putting out genuine content, not bullshit whatever stuff, right? Although the video that went kind of viral was kind of bullshit whatever stuff.
What I like about your content, though, Lando, is that you're positive. And I think that's another piece of it, too. You don't always have to be positive. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there that make negative content that it's like they don't understand why people don't watch it. It's
and you can't
clear
be too positive either. Those guys out there that are like explosive positive, it's a little bit too much, right?
Yeah, you got to be genuine for sure.
You know, I don't post nearly enough. When we first started doing this, we went to an internet marketing company that told us that we need to post on Meta 3 times a day. 3 times a day, every day, you need to post. And that's just to stay relevant. And it's funny because Shelly does a local farmer's market here, and you get to be one-on-one with the people that are in your community, which is a big thing. And everybody says, "We see your stuff on Instagram and on Facebook all the time. Great, it's working. Like, that's what we're supposed to be doing, right?" And she gets a little bit of criticism from some of the other market people. And it's actually kind of funny because there's been some that, you know, they see the success that we're doing in our community and they'll come up and they'll kind of, you know, "So what do you do? Like, how do you do this?" And Shelly says, "You gotta hit Instagram and Facebook 3 times every day, at least, and Twitter and LinkedIn, whatever. Like, if there's a social media outlet out there, hit it hard and keep hitting it. And re-engage with the people. When they make comments, give a thumbs up, comment on it. Yeah, you're right. Ha ha, whatever." Or, you know, Or if there somebody's being off base, say, hey, I don't agree with that. Whatever. You just have to be real. And I mean, we haven't hit your numbers or anything. But you know, at the same time, it is bringing us more people in, and we're getting more followers, and we're seeing some business from that too, right? And that's what's going to keep driving that.
There's another side to what I've done, though, is it really actually does nothing for me at the given moment, having a video go viral, but having no business to back it up, essentially.
Yeah.
It's almost pointless for me to be putting in that work that I'm putting in towards my reels and stuff like that, in a way. Although there's the other side to it, where you're growing that audience so that when you do finally get to releasing a product, that you've got that following already, right? But if you don't have a plan to release product down the line, then what are you doing, right? You're trying to become a influencer or something, maybe. But again, it comes down to that plan, right? You have to have a plan on how you're going to release product. And one of the things that I'm kind of where I'm going with that is, okay, so what you do, Nick, is you provide a service for people. Brian, on the other hand, provides a product for people. So there's mm-hmm. two different sales tactics that go into place there. As a promotion for a service, you have to kind of reach out in your local community. For a product, you could be worldwide as far as you can reach, right? When it comes to promoting product, though, how do you go about promoting your product in that essence? Do you worry about hitting all the social medias, or is there a different approach to promoting your product? Like, for example, you do the advertisements for Come Take a Class, and they can be funny, right? But when you're going for selling a product, can you attach that same essence to it?
Yeah, I mean, products and services, the marketing side of things is fairly same. You know, my marketing strategy is just show people what to do with it. You know, like, this is what I'm doing with it. And I'm also a very curious person, so I'm like always going off on a tangent. For instance, I'm working on these like copper coins that I'm making for no reason. I'm just wanted to learn, you know, how to forge or how to melt something and then pour it into a mold. And then I'm like, okay, so now I'm holding this thing and I'm like, well, how am I going to make this make any money? Or, you know, what am I looking at here? Does it even need to? You know, that's the other question.
Well, how do I get a Brian House?
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. Right there. That's the point. So I just made this one today, and it's like it's a little copper coin that I 3D printed the mold thing. It's cool, right? So, yeah. Right? It's like a little doubloon. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it looks like I found it on the beach, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
that's awesome, dude. Yeah.
So
pirate booty.
Yes. And so I think to myself, like, well, maybe when I go to like polish this thing up, I'll use the Revolution, right? I'll maybe clean it up a little bit or whatever. Or maybe I'll melt the copper in the Apollo or whatever. It's things like that where I'm just showing people the tools that I make, and inevitably people look at that and go, what is that? I want that. I want to, you know, or I want to do what you're doing. So you've heard the statement, you don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle, right? The point of everything we do is inspiration. I want to show people I'm making a knife today. Check this out. I just made this. This is great. I use these tools. You know, this is XYZ. This is my process. Same with Nick. Check out what these people did in my workshop today. They made these knives. They made these things. Mm-hmm. You're selling the sizzle. You're not selling, you know, the actual steel and the copper and the wood and all of that. You're selling an experience, because
100%.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, that's all we have, right? When you go in the ground, when you're dead and gone, you can't take any of this shit with you, but you can bring those memories with you. Every single day, I will never forget certain times in my life, and they were all experiences. I'm not a thing person per se.
Dude, Dude, Jim Carrey has a video out there where he reflected on, he was told he has 10 minutes left because if something was going, I don't know what the fucking deal was or whatever, but he was like, dude, all I did, I didn't panic. I didn't go and, you know, I didn't freak out. I started reflecting on all the things I'm thankful for in life. And those are the memories that you're talking about that you hold on to for the rest of your life, right?
Right. Exactly. And we attribute our tools to those experiences as well. Like when we say something to someone like, what's your goal? What do you want to do with this thing? And they go, I want to make knives. Well, what do you want to sell the knives? And most of the guys don't, you know, they just want something to do. They want a project. They want to put something together. They want to do it with their son or their father. And they want that thing in their garage that they can say, I made that. Check that out. I built that. Oh, cool. All right, let's go make something with it. That's an experience. Same with the classes that Nick is doing. You know, the point of that is, and I'm sure you see a lot of this, Nick, is where there's two people that show up to the same class because they're friends or they're married or whatever, and they want to experience it together, right?
Bachelor parties. We get, you know, companies that do employee, you know, team building exercises. We get like it's
corporate bonding. Building.
Corporate bonding.
Team building, yeah.
And so many fathers and sons. So many fathers and sons. You know, it's awesome. It's really cool.
Okay, so I got the perspective from you guys as knife maker, as somebody who provides a service on what you guys can do in order to promote yourselves. And I'm full agreeance that, you know, give people the experience. But what about artistic blacksmiths or architectural blacksmiths, guys that are promoting or building stuff like gates or building stuff like sculpture? How do you give people the experience when it comes to that? What's your guys' perspective on that?
I think that'd be more of a Nick question, but I would say my perspective on it is with artistic blacksmithing, I see it more like you're learning a trade. You know, you're learning something that you're going to take with you to make money. And I guess it's really similar to knife making too, because that's really common.
But I mean more on the side of the thing, like say, for example, myself, I'm an artistic blacksmith. I want to build small sculptures, gates and stuff like that. How do I promote myself? How do I promote my product? What do I do? Give me some ideas.
If you want to build, let's say you want to build staircases, maybe you want to do railings. You go to new home builders that are building high scale, upscale houses. You're showing them what you can do. You're bringing product to them. These are the spindles I make. These are the railings I make. These are, you know, what do you think? Is this marketable? If you're going to build gates, you go to higher end fencing companies that need gates. You know, you're working on this, you know, this stone wall fence and you need a gate for it. Well, this is the gate that I built. What do you think of this? You know, and you have to put in legwork. You got to get out there and beat down every door, because it's not, you know, you're going to be selling in your local market. You know, you could, you know, ship a gate halfway across the country, but you know,
there's sculpture sides to it too, right? There's this, you know, like this small sculpture.
I just watched a piece on you know, Mike Rowe. He's got a YouTube channel
Dirty
now.
Jobs.
Dirty Jobs. And I think the name of his show now is called Somebody Has to Do It, or Somebody Had to Do It, or something like that. And he did a piece with a blacksmith, an artisan blacksmith, that you should watch, Lando.
Okay.
Because in the beginning, they walk over to a chandelier that he's building. And the guy tells the story about the chandelier, how he made one, and then a general contractor that builds large, you know, homes for very wealthy people saw it and called, you know, sought him out and said, I need seven of these. How do I get seven of these? And he said, you know, I can make you seven of them. That's fine. And then Mike asks, how much are these chandeliers? Like, what does this cost? And he says, they're $10,000 a piece. And I realized at that point that you know, there's a lot of money in that work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you see the chandelier, you and I don't think I could make one, but I know you could make one. They're it's not that ornate. It's beautiful, but it's just, when I look at it, I go, yeah, I could probably figure out how to make that, you know, whatever. It's not like a lot of very, very, very detailed work.
Your cousin and, Ira would, right?
Ira would definitely know how to make this. Yes. The piece that I took away from that was that this general contractor saw it in someone else's home and then probably sold it to one of their customers. You know, they're building big log cabins or something. The first place I would stop if I were you is I would create a small media kit, like a small printable media kit that had some very good photos of your work, that had a QR code that would take them to a landing page, and it would, show all your latest work. Okay. And I would take that card and it would be like a rack card, like a 4x6 or 5x7. And I would drop it off of every interior designer in your town or close to it. And also every general contractor that's building homes that could use something like what you're making. Cause there's a lot of these guys building these. Yes.
And stuff like that.
And here's why the interior designers are important. The interior designers are going to take your thing and they're going to sell it to them and upsell it. Mm-hmm. So you're selling it to the interior designer, not to the customer, and they're going to make a little money on it. So they're, and then what'll happen is you get all this repeat business because, you know, rich people love to hang out with each other. And then they also like to say, this was made in Manitoba by a man named, you know, Lando Novak, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they love to tell the story and they love to, you know, and then how do I get one? You know, oh, it was only $12,000. Oh my gosh, what a steal. Like, you know, that kind of stuff happens, believe it or not. Totally. And it happens a lot. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and so you have to think in terms of that, but you got to get plugged in. And that goes back to our relationships conversation where, you know, you're doing that type of thing locally. So
yeah. Speaking about plugged in and relationships, we haven't brought up Maritime Knife Supply yet. If you're not following Maritime Knife Supply, head on over to maritimeknifesupply.ca. You can use the code FSCKiln at checkout and save yourself $100 on Paragon or even heat kilns. And you can also hone in on the great deal, like we were talking about earlier, buy in bulk, buy 10 grinding belts. You'll save yourself 10%. That's a free belt. And Maritime Knife Supply is Canadian owned and operated. You can't go wrong with ordering from Lawrence. You'll get those shipments in quicker than almost anywhere else you can order from. He's a great place to support. Highly recommend it. So does Brian. I know you guys support Lawrence as well, and he supports you. So like we said, community driven. Lawrence is part of the community. He's an awesome person to work with. Highly recommend you check him out. Give him a shout out if there's something on the website that you don't see that you want. He's super awesome about getting that kind of stuff too. There's also DeTwillerLinseedOil.com that you can head on over to. DeTwiller Linseed Oil is a locally made product in Saskatchewan. These are two brothers that are putting seed in ground, pulling that seed out, going and putting it in their shop, pressing that seed and getting the oil for you, putting it in canisters, and we can save you guys 10% on orders $50 or more if you use the code ForgeChat10 at checkout. Matt, I just talked to Dawson the other day. He is loving doing this stuff. He's expanding. He's looking at building his own specific facility, you guys. He's not going to be doing this out of his little garage anymore. He's going to have an actual press shop soon. Exciting news. Super pumped for the guy.
Awesome.
That's the awesome. TwillerLinseedOil.com. You know,
and taking a page from Brian's book here, if you're south of the border and you want to get any of these products, we take Canadian pesos. So, yeah. You're getting a real good exchange rate there. You're going to save money.
Isn't it the other way around? Aren't we the pesos?
yeah. We the Canadian pesos. Oh, yeah. Yeah. What is a U.S. dollar now? It's like 15 Canadian dollars.
It's like the euro to us nowadays.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Is that true? Is the Canadian dollar that bad? Oh, my gosh.
I think it's like 70 cents,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. It's still saving another 30% right there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 We ship some stuff into Canada and it always amazes me, like the layers of collections that go on with the taxation up there. So it's like, we always warn our customer. We go, you know, look, if you want us to send it to you, but what we, here's what I love about living in South Florida. A ton of Canadians come here to vacation. And so I'll get a message from somebody and I'll say, hey, I'm from wherever, usually Quebec or Toronto or, you know, one of the bigger cities. They're coming down and they usually drive and they'll say, hey, I'd love to come by and just pick it up, you know, and that way they save themselves the money as they go across the border.
That's right.
And it works out because I love the Canadian people. I am like, I just feel connected. A lot of my friends are Canadians. And it's funny because like Dennis Terrell, who lives in California, is a close friend of mine, just happens to be Canadian. Yeah. So it's like all these connections, like Nate Wapol, Walrus Steel, lives in Vermont. He's a Canadian. Like it's this, it, I don't know what it is, but I connect really well. And I think it's because I grew up in the Midwest. Yeah. And, you know, I, it's
almost Canadian.
We're a lot of the same. Yeah, it's a lot of the same. And so
a little, the same.
Little bit. Yeah. I've been in Florida 20 years, so it's a little bit different, but the, what I love about it is that, or what I wish I could do more is import my goods into Canada and make it more affordable. I just, it's just like nearly impossible, you know, without doing huge, massive imports and figuring that out. Maybe at some point.
You start a Canadian facility.
Yeah, that's,
that was a thought. That was a thought.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know Bob and Doug McKenzie, dude?
I do not.
Okay. No. Oh, well, then we can't really help get you to do the closer with us, I guess. We're getting into a period here where we're going to have to throw the sheepskin on this and wrap it up. So
sure.
If you don't mind, Nick, you want to help me do the good old Kurukuku?
I certainly can. You ready?
Let's do it, bro. Start me off.
Good day.
Good day.
Brian, it was absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, my man. I really hope that people can take a lot from what we talked about as far as running a business with you, man. You were episode 101, and half the reason why we have to kind of cut this off right now is I'm actually jumping back in time right now to go record episode 99 with Mark Pierce.
I love it. I love it. Go. Well, thank you so much, guys, for having me on. Thing. And sure.
Before we kind of got cut off with that technical difficulty, I was going to tell a joke.
Yeah.
I was going to tell a joke. Pirate joke, because Brian showed us a little pirate coin. So, all right. I'm going to screw this up, but I'm going to give it a go. What do you call... Okay. What does a pirate lesbian amputee say?
Oh, jeez.
This is... Arr, scissor me timbers.
That's really good. That's really good. It was way better than I thought it was going to be, honestly. The lead up, I was like, oh man, he's going to screw this. No, that's great.
That was beautiful.
So good.
Brilliant.
I've had I don't know if you guys know this, but I've been addicted to drinking brake fluid, but I'm telling everyone I can stop whenever I want.
You guys might not know this, but in my earlier days, I started a religion somewhat based on pirate stuff. I mean, pirate booty. My religion is called Buddhism. It's all about worshiping the ass.
That's pretty bad. Yeah, I like it.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys. It was awesome sitting down with you all. You have a good day.
Thanks again.
Good day.
And go figure that we did not do Song of the Week once again. So excited to talk to Brian House that we forgot to bring it up. So I reached out, and here's Brian's Song of the Week.
So I've been listening to a lot of Deadmau5 for some reason, just kind of like techno EDM, sort of old stuff. And there's one song in particular on the 4x4 album. And it's called City in Florida. Great song.
As you could tell in the background, Brian's working for it, as always. So now we'll move over to get Nick's song choice of the week. I'd be surprised to hear what he has.
I've been listening to a little Black Sabbath in the Forge this week. Little Iron Man. Good old Ozzy.
And that's our good old Welshie for you. Always going with something pretty radio-esque, if you'd ask me there. But that's awesome, man. I love the guy. He's always laying back on those things. I'm going to follow up with something kind of typical. My choice is going to be Metallica. Orion, coming in from Master of Puppets album. I did an edit with my snowboarding to this song back in the day, and it was freaking awesome. Thank you all. Good day.